Black Boy, Disc 5.
Chapter 4. Granny was an ardent member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and I was compelled to make a pretense of worshiping her God, which was her exaction for my keep. The elders of her church expounded a gospel clogged with images of vast lakes of eternal fire, of seas vanishing, of valleys of dry bones, of the sun burning to ashes, of the moon turning to blood, of stars falling to earth, of a wooden staff being transformed into a serpent, of voices speaking out of clouds, of men walking upon water, of God riding whirlwinds, of water changing into wine, of the dead rising and living, of the blind seeing, of the lame walking, a salvation that teemed with fantastic beasts having multiple heads and horns and eyes and feet, sermons of statues possessing heads of gold, shoulders of silver, legs of brass, and feet of clay, a cosmic tale that began before time and ended with the clouds of the sky rolling away at the second coming of Christ, chronicles that concluded with the Armageddon, dramas thronged with all the billions of human beings who had ever lived or died as God judged the quick and the dead. While listening to the vivid language of the sermons, I was pulled toward emotional belief, but as soon as I went out of the church and saw the bright sunshine and felt the throbbing life of the people in the streets, I knew that none of it was true and that nothing would happen. Once again, I knew hunger, biting hunger. Hunger that made my body aimlessly restless. Hunger that kept me on edge, that made my temper flare. Hunger that made hate leap out of my heart like the dart of a serpent's tongue. Hunger that created in me odd cravings. No food that I could dream of seemed half so utterly delicious as vanilla wafers. Every time I had a nickel, I would run to the grocery store and buy a box of vanilla wafers and walk back home, slowly, so that I could eat them all up without having to share them with anyone. Then I would sit on the front steps and dream of eating another box. The craving would finally become so acute that I would force myself to be active in order to forget. I learned a method of drinking water that made me feel full temporarily, whether I had a desire for water or not. I would put my mouth under a faucet and turn the water on full force and let the stream cascade into my stomach until it was tight. Sometimes my stomach ached, but I felt full for a moment. No pork or veal was ever eaten at Granny's, and rarely was there meat of any kind. We seldom ate fish, and then only those that had scales and spines. Baking powder was never used. It was alleged to contain a chemical harmful to the body. For breakfast, I ate mush and gravy made from flour and lard, and for hours afterwards I would belch it up into my mouth. We were constantly taking bicarbonate of soda for indigestion. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I ate a plate of greens cooked with lard. Sometimes on Sundays we bought a dime's worth of beef, which usually turned out to be uneatable. Granny's favorite dish was a peanut roast, which she made to resemble meat, but which tasted like something else. My position in the household was a delicate one. I was a minor, an uninvited dependent, a blood relative who professed no salvation and whose soul stood in mortal peril. Granny intimated boldly, basing her logic on God's justice, that one sinful person in a household could bring down the wrath of God upon the entire establishment, damning both the innocent and the guilty. And on more than one occasion, she interpreted my mother's long illness as the result of my faithlessness. I became skilled in ignoring these cosmic threats and developed a callousness toward all metaphysical preachments. But Granny won an ally in her efforts to persuade me to confess her God. Aunt Addie, her youngest child, had had just finished the Seventh-day Adventist religious school in Huntsville, Alabama, and came home to argue that if the family was compassionate enough to feed me, then the least I could do in return was to follow its guidance. She proposed that, when the fall school term started, I should be enrolled in the religious school rather than the secular one. If I refused, I was placing myself not only in the position of a horrible infidel, but of a hard-hearted ingrate. I raised arguments and objections, but my mother sided with Granny and Aunt Addie, and I had to accept. The religious school opened, and I put in a sullen attendance. 20 pupils, ranging in age from 5 to 19, and in grades from primary to high school, were crowded into one room. Aunt Addie was the only teacher, and from the first day, an acute, bitter antagonism sprang up between us. This was the first time she had ever taught school, and she was nervous, self-conscious because a blood relative of hers, a relative who would not confess her faith and who was not a member of her church, was in her classroom. She was determined that every student should know that I was a sinner of whom she did not approve and that I was not to be granted consideration of any kind. The pupils were a docile lot, lacking in that keen sense of rivalry which made the boys and girls who went to public school a crowd in which a boy was tested and weighed, in which he caught a glimpse of what the world was. These boys and girls were willless, their speech flat, their gestures vague, their personalities devoid of anger, hope, laughter, enthusiasm, passion, or despair. I was able to see them with an objectivity that was inconceivable to them. They were claimed wholly by their environment and could imagine no other, whereas I had come from another plane of living, from the swinging doors of saloons, the railroad yard, the roundhouses, the street gangs, the river levees, an orphan home, had shifted from town to town and home to home, had mingled with grown-ups more than perhaps was good for me. I had to curb my habit of cursing, but not before I had shocked more than half of them and had embarrassed Aunt Addie to helplessness. As the first week of school drew to a close, the conflict that smoldered between Aunt Addie and me flared openly. One afternoon, she rose from her desk and walked down the aisle and stopped beside me. "You know better than that," she said, tapping a ruler across my knuckles. "Better than what?" I asked, amazed, nursing my hand. "Just look at that floor," she said. I looked and saw that there were tiny bits of walnut meat scattered about. Some of them had been smeared into grease spots on the clean white pine boards. At once, I knew that the boy in front of me had been eating them. My walnuts were in my pocket, uncracked. "I don't know anything about that," I said. "You know better than to eat in the classroom," she said. "I haven't been eating," I said. "Don't lie. This is not only a school, but God's holy ground," she said with angry indignation. "Aunt Addie, my walnuts are here in my pocket." "I'm Miss Wilson," she shouted. I stared at her, speechless, at last comprehending what was really bothering her. She had warned me to call her Miss Wilson in the classroom, and for the most part I had done so. She was afraid that if I called her Aunt Addie, I would undermine the morale of the students. Each pupil knew that she was my aunt, and many of them had known her longer than I had. "I'm sorry," I said, and turned from her and opened a book. "Richard, get up." I didn't move. The room was tense. My fingers gripped the book, and I knew that every pupil in the room was watching. I hadn't eaten the nuts. I was sorry that I had called her Aunt Addie, but I didn't want to be singled out for gratuitous punishment. And, too, I was expecting the boy who sat in front of me to devise some lie to save me, since it was really he who was guilty. "I asked you to get up," she shouted. I still sat, not taking my eyes off the book. Suddenly she caught me by the back of my collar and yanked me from the seat. I stumbled across the room. "I spoke to you," she shouted hysterically. I straightened and looked at her. There was hate in my eyes. Don't you look at me that way, boy. I didn't put those walnuts on the floor. Then who did? My street gang code was making it hard for me. I had never informed upon a boy in the public school, and I was waiting for the boy in front of me to come to my aid, lying, making up excuses, anything. In the past, I had taken punishment that was not mine to protect the solidarity of the gang, and I had seen other boys do the same. But the religious boy, God helping him, didn't speak. I don't know who did it, I said finally. Go to the front of the room, Aunt Addie said. I walked slowly to her desk, expecting to be lectured, but my heart quickened when I saw her go to the corner and select a long, green, limber switch and come toward me. I lost control of my temper. I haven't done anything, I yelled. She struck me, and I dodged. Stand still, boy, she blazed, her face livid with fury, her body trembling. I stood still, feeling more defeated by the righteous boy behind me than by Aunt Addie. Hold out your hand. I held out my hand, vowing that never again would this happen to me, no matter what the price. She stung my palm until it was red, then lashed me across my bare legs until welts rose. I clamped my teeth to keep from uttering a single whimper. When she finished, I continued to hold out my hand, indicating to her that her blows could never really reach me, my eyes fixed and unblinking upon her face. Put down your hand and go to your seat, she said. I dropped my hand and turned on my heels, my palm and legs on fire, my body taut. I walked in a fog of anger toward my desk. And I'm not through with you, she called after me. She had said one word too much. Before I knew it, I had whirled and was staring at her with an open mouth and blazing eyes. Through with me, I repeated. But what have I done to you? Sit down and shut up, Aunt Addie bellowed. I sat. I was sure of one thing. I would not be beaten by her again. I had often been painfully beaten, but almost always I had felt that the beatings were somehow right and sensible, that I was in the wrong. Now, for the first time, I felt the equal of an adult. I knew that I had been beaten for a reason that wasn't right. I sensed some emotional problem in Aunt Addie, other than her concern about my eating in school. Did my presence make her feel so insecure that she felt she had to punish me in front of the pupils to impress them? All afternoon I brooded, wondering how I could quit the school. The moment Aunt Addie came into the house, I reached home before she did. She called me into the kitchen. When I entered, I saw that she was holding another switch. My muscles tightened. You're not going to beat me again, I told her. I'm going to teach you some manners, she said. I stood fighting as I had never fought in my life, fighting with myself. Perhaps my uneasy childhood, perhaps my shifting from town to town, perhaps the violence I had already seen and felt took hold of me, and I was trying to stifle the impulse to go to the drawer of the kitchen table and get a knife and defend myself. But this woman who stood before me was my aunt, my mother's sister, Granny's daughter. In her veins my own blood flowed. In many of her actions I could see some elusive part of my own self, and in her speech I could catch echoes of my own speech. I didn't want to be violent with her, and yet I didn't want to be beaten for a wrong I had not committed. You're just mad at me for something, I said. Don't tell me I'm mad. You're too mad to believe anything I say. Don't speak to me like that. Then how can I talk to you? You beat me for throwing walnuts on the floor, but I didn't do it. Then who did? Since I was alone now with her and desperate, I cast my loyalties aside and told her the name of the guilty boy, feeling that he merited no consideration.
Why didn't you tell me that before? She asked.
I don't want to tell tales on other people.
So you lied, huh?
I couldn't talk. I couldn't explain how much I valued my code of solidarity.
Hold out your hand.
You're not going to beat me. I didn't do it.
I'm going to beat you for lying.
Don't hit me. If you hit me, I'll fight you. For a moment, she hesitated, then struck at me with a switch, and I dodged and stumbled into a corner. She was upon me, lashing me across the face. I leaped, screaming, and ran past her and jerked open the kitchen drawer. It spilled to the floor with a thunderous sound. I grabbed up a knife and held it, ready for her.
Now I told you to stop, I screamed. You put down that knife. Leave me alone or I'll cut you.
She stood, debating. Then she made up her mind and came at me. I lunged at her with the knife, and she grasped my hand and tried to twist the knife loose. I threw my right leg about her legs and gave her a shove, tripping her. We crashed to the floor. She was stronger than I, and I felt my strength ebbing. She was still fighting for my knife, and I saw a look on her face that made me feel she was going to use it on me if she got possession of it. I bit her hand and we rolled, kicking, scratching, hitting, fighting as though we were strangers, deadly enemies, fighting for our lives.
Leave me alone, I screamed at the top of my voice. Give me that knife, you boy. I'll kill you. I'll kill you if you don't leave me alone.
Granny came running. She stood thunderstruck.
Addie, what are you doing?
He's got a knife, she gasped. Make him put it down.
Richard, put down that knife, Granny shouted.
My mother came limping to the door.
Richard, stop it, she shouted.
I won't. I'm not going to let it beat me.
Addie, leave the boy alone, my mother said.
Aunt Addie rose slowly, her eyes on the knife. Then she turned and walked out of the kitchen, kicking the door wide open before her as she went.
Richard, give me that knife, my mother said.
But Mama, she'll beat me. Beat me for nothing, I said. I'm not going to let her beat me. I don't care what happens.
Richard, you are bad, bad, Granny said, weeping.
I tried to explain what had happened, but neither of them would listen. Granny came toward me to take the knife, but I dodged her and ran into the backyard. I sat alone on the back steps, trembling, emotionally spent, crying to myself. Grandpa came down. Aunt Addie had told him what had happened.
Give me that knife, mister, he said.
I've already put it back,
I lied, hugging my arm to my side to conceal the knife.
What's come over you? He asked.
I don't want her to beat me, I said.
You're a child, a boy, he thundered.
But I don't want to be beaten.
What did you do?
Nothing.
You can lie as fast as a dog can trot, Grandpa said. And if it wasn't for my rheumatism, I'd take down your pants and tan your backside good and proper. The very idea of a little snot like you threatening somebody with a knife.
I'm not going to let her beat me, I said again.
You're bad, he said. You better watch your step, young man, or you'll end up on the gallows.
I had long ceased to fear Grandpa. He was a sick old man, and he knew nothing of what was happening in the house. Now and then the womenfolk called on him to throw fear into someone, but I knew that he was feeble and was not frightened of him. wrapped in the misty memories of his young manhood, he sat his days out in his room where his Civil War rifle stood loaded in a corner, where his blue uniform of the Union Army lay neatly folded. Aunt Addie took her defeat hard, holding me in a cold and silent disdain. I was conscious that she had descended to my own emotional level in her effort to rule me, and my respect for her sank. Until she married years later, we rarely spoke to each other, though we ate at the same table and slept under the same roof. Though I was but a skinny, half-frightened boy, and she was the secretary of the church and the church's day school teacher, God blessed our home with the love that binds. I continued at the church school despite Aunt Addie's never calling upon me to recite or go to the blackboard. Consequently, I stopped studying. I spent my time playing with the boys and found that the only games they knew were brutal ones. Baseball, marbles, boxing, running were tabooed recreations, the devil's work. Instead, they played a wildcat game called popping the whip, a seemingly innocent diversion whose excitement came only in spurts, but spurts that could hurl one to the edge of death itself. Whenever we were discovered standing idle on the school grounds, Aunt Addie would suggest that we pop the whip. It would have been safer for our bodies and saner for our souls had she urged us to shoot craps. One day at noon, Aunt Addie ordered us to pop the whip. I had never played the game before, and I fell in with good faith. We formed a long line, each boy taking hold of another boy's hand, until we were stretched out like a long string of human beads. Although I didn't know it, I was on the tip end of the human whip. The leading boy, the handle of the whip, started off at a trot, weaving to the left and to the right, increasing speed until the whip of flesh was curving at breakneck gallop. I clutched the hand of the boy next to me with all the strength I had, sensing that if I didn't hold on, I would be tossed off. The whip grew taut as human flesh and bone could bear, and I felt that my arm was being torn from its socket. Suddenly, my breath left me. I was swung in a small, sharp arc. The whip was now being popped, and I could hold on no more. The momentum of the whip flung me off my feet into the air, like a bit of leather being flicked off a horsewhip, and I hurtled headlong through space and landed in a ditch. I rolled over, stunned, head bruised and bleeding. Aunt Addie was laughing, the first and only time I ever saw her laugh on God's holy ground. In the home, Granny maintained a hard religious regime. There were prayers at sunup and sundown, at the breakfast table and dinner table, followed by a Bible verse from each member of the family, and it was presumed that I prayed before I got into bed at night. I shirked as many of the weekday church services as possible, giving as my excuse that I had to study. Of course, nobody believed me, but my lies were accepted because nobody wanted to risk a row. The daily prayers were a torment, and my knees became sore from kneeling so long and often. Finally, I devised a method of kneeling that was not really kneeling. I learned, through arduous repetition, how to balance myself on the toes of my shoes and rest my head against a wall in some convenient corner. Nobody, except God, was any the wiser, and I did not think that he cared. Granny made it imperative, however, that I attend certain all-night ritualistic prayer meetings. She was the oldest member of her church, and it would have been unseemly if the only grandchild in her home couldn't be brought to these important services. She felt that if I were completely remiss in religious conformity, it would cast doubt upon the staunchness of her faith, her capacity to convince and persuade, or merely upon her ability to apply the rod to my backside. Granny would prepare a lunch for the all-night praying session, and the three of us, Granny, Aunt Addie, and I, would be off, leaving my mother and Grandpa at home. During the passionate prayers and the chanted hymns, I would sit squirming on the bench, longing to grow up so I could run away, listening indifferently to the theme of cosmic annihilation, loving the hymns for their sensual caress, but at last casting furtive glances at Granny and wondering when it would be safe for me to stretch out on the bench and go to sleep. At 10 or 11, I would munch a sandwich, and Granny would nod her permission for me to take a nap. I would awaken at intervals to hear snatches of hymns or prayers that would lull me to sleep again. Finally, Granny would shake me, and I would open my eyes and see the sun streaming through stained glass windows. Many of the religious symbols appealed to my sensibilities, and I responded to the dramatic vision of life held by the church, feeling that to live day by day with death as one sole thought was to be so compassionately sensitive toward all life as to view all men as slowly dying, and the trembling sense of fate that welled up, sweet and melancholy, from the hymns, blended with a sense of fate that I had already caught from life. But full emotional and intellectual belief never came. Perhaps if I had caught my first sense of life from the church, I would have been moved to complete acceptance. But the hymns and sermons of God came into my heart only long after my personality had been shaped and formed by uncharted conditions of life. I felt that I had in me a sense of living as deep as that which the church was trying to give me, and in the end, I remained basically unaffected. My body grew, even on mush and lard gravy, a miracle which the church certainly should have claimed credit for. I survived my 12th year on a diet that would have stunted an average-sized dog, and my glands began to diffuse through my blood like sap rising upward in trees in spring, those strange chemicals that made me look curiously at girls and women. The elder's wife sang in the choir, and I fell in love with her, as only a 12-year-old can worship a distant and unattainable woman. During the services, I would stare at her, wondering what it was like to be married to her, pondering over how passionate she was. I felt no qualms about my first lust for the flesh being born on holy ground. The contrast between budding carnal desires and the aching loneliness of the hymns never evoked any sense of guilt in me. It was possible that the sweetly sonorous hymns stimulated me sexually, and it might have been that my fleshy fantasies in turn, having as their foundation my already inflated sensibility, made me love the masochistic prayers. It was highly likely that the serpent of sin that nosed about the chambers of my heart was lashed to hunger by hymns as well as dreams, each reciprocally feeding the other. The church's spiritual life must have been polluted by my base yearnings, by the leaping hunger of my blood for the flesh, because I would gaze at the elder's wife for hours, attempting to draw her eyes to mine, trying to hypnotize her, seeking to communicate with her with my thoughts. If my desires had been converted into a concrete religious symbol, the symbol would have looked something like this: a black imp with two horns, a long, curving, forked tail, cloven hoofs, a scaly, naked body, wet, sticky fingers, moist, sensual lips, and lascivious eyes feasting upon the face of the elder's wife. A religious revival was announced, and Granny felt that it was her last chance to bring me to God before I entered the precincts of sin at the public school, for I had already given loud and final notice that I would no longer attend the church school. There was a discernible lessening in Aunt Addie's hostility. Perhaps she had come to the conclusion that my lost soul was more valuable than petty pride. Even my mother's attitude was, "Richard, you ought to know God through some church." The entire family became kind and forgiving, but I knew the motives that prompted their change, and it drove me an ever greater emotional distance from them. Some of my classmates, who had, on the advice of their parents, avoided me, now came to visit, and I could tell in a split second that they had been instructed in what to say.
One boy, who lived across the street, called on me one afternoon, and his self-consciousness betrayed him. He spoke so naively and clumsily that I could see the bare bones of his holy plot and hear the creaking of the machinery of Granny's maneuvering.
"Richard, do you know we are all worried about you?" he asked.
"Worried about me? Who's worried about me?" I asked in feigned surprise.
"All of us," he said, his eyes avoiding mine.
"Why?"
I asked.
"You're not saved," he said sadly.
"I'm all right," I said, laughing.
"Don't laugh, Richard. It's serious," he said.
"But I tell you that I'm all right."
"Say, Richard, I'd like to be a good friend of yours."
"I thought we were friends already," I said.
"I mean true brothers in Christ," he said.
"We know each other,"
I said in a soft voice tinged with irony.
"But not in Christ," he said.
"Friendship is friendship with me."
"But don't you want to save your soul?"
"I simply can't feel religion,"
I told him in lieu of telling him that I didn't think I had the kind of soul he thought I had.
"Have you really tried to feel God?" he asked.
"No, but I know I can't feel anything like that."
"You simply can't let the question rest there, Richard."
"Why should I let it rest?"
"Don't mock God," he said.
"I'll never feel God, I tell you. It's no use."
"Would you let the fate of your soul hang upon pride and vanity?"
"I don't think I have any pride in matters like this."
"Richard, think of Christ dying for you, shedding his blood, his precious blood on the cross."
"Other people have shed blood," I ventured.
"But it's not the same. You don't understand."
"I don't think I ever will."
"Oh, Richard, brother, you are lost in the darkness of the world. You must let the church help you."
"I tell you, I'm all right."
"Come into the house and let me pray for you."
"I don't want to hurt your feelings."
"You can't. I'm talking for God."
"I don't want to hurt God's feelings either," I said,
the words slipping irreverently from my lips before I was aware of their full meaning. He was shocked. He wiped tears from his eyes. I was sorry.
"Don't say that. God may never forgive you," he whispered.
It would have been impossible for me to have told him how I felt about religion. I had not settled in my mind whether I believed in God or not. His existence or non-existence never worried me. I reasoned that if there did exist an all-wise, all-powerful God who knew the beginning and the end, who meted out justice to all, who controlled the destiny of man, this God would surely know that I doubted his existence, and he would laugh at my foolish denial of him. And if there was no God at all, then why all the commotion? I couldn't imagine God pausing in his guidance of unimaginably vast worlds to bother with me. Embedded in me was a notion of the suffering in life, but none of it seemed like the consequences of original sin to me. I simply couldn't feel weak and lost in a cosmic manner. Before I had been made to go to church, I had given God's existence a sort of tacit assent. But after having seen his creatures serve him at first hand, I'd had my doubts. My faith, such as it was welded to the common realities of life, anchored in the sensations of my body, and in what my mind could grasp, and nothing could ever shake this faith, and surely not my fear of an invisible power.
"I'm not afraid of things like that," I told the boy.
"Aren't you afraid of God?" he asked.
"No, why should I be? I've done nothing to him."
"He's a jealous God," he warned me.
"I hope that he's a kind God," I told him.
If you are kind to him, he is a kind God, the boy said. But God will not look at you if you don't look at him.
During our talk, I made a hypothetical statement that summed up my attitude toward God and the suffering in the world, a statement that stemmed from my knowledge of life as I had lived, seen, felt, and suffered it in terms of dread, fear, hunger, terror, and loneliness. If laying down my life could stop the suffering in the world, I'd do it. I don't believe anything can stop it, I told him. He heard me, but he did not speak. I wanted to say more to him, but I knew that it would have been useless. Though older than I, he had neither known nor felt anything of life for himself. He had been carefully reared by his mother and father, and he had always been told what to feel. Don't be angry, I told him. Frightened and baffled, he left me. I felt sorry for him. Immediately following the boy's visit, Granny began her phase of the campaign. The boy had no doubt conveyed to her my words of blasphemy, for she talked with me for hours, warning me that I would burn forever in the lake of fire. As the day of the revival grew near, the pressure upon me intensified. I would go into the dining room upon some petty errand and find Granny kneeling, her head resting on a chair, uttering my name in a tensely whispered prayer. God was suddenly everywhere in the home, even in Aunt Addie's scowling and brooding face. It began to weigh upon me. I longed for the time when I could leave. They begged me so continuously to come to God that it was impossible for me to ignore them without wounding them. Desperately, I tried to think of some way to say no without making them hate me. I was determined to leave home before I would surrender. Then I blundered and wounded Granny's soul. It was not my intention to hurt or humiliate her. The irony of it was that the plan I conceived had as its purpose the salving of Granny's frustrated feelings toward me. Instead, it brought her the greatest shame and humiliation of her entire religious life. One evening, during a sermon, I heard the elder. I took my eyes off his wife long enough to listen, even though she slumbered in my senses all the while. Describe how Jacob had seen an angel. Immediately, I felt that I had found a way to tell Granny that I needed proof before I could believe, that I couldn't commit myself to something I couldn't feel or see. I would tell her that if I were to see an angel, I would accept that as infallible evidence that there was a God and would serve him unhesitatingly. She would surely understand an attitude of that sort. What gave me courage to voice this argument was the conviction that I would never see an angel. If I had ever seen one, I had enough common sense to have gone to a doctor at once. With my bright idea bubbling in my mind, wishing to allay Granny's fears for my soul, wanting to make her know that my heart was not all black and wrong, that I was actually giving serious thought to her passionate pleadings, I leaned to her and whispered, "You see, Granny, if I ever saw an angel like Jacob did, then I'd believe." Granny stiffened and stared at me in amazement. Then a glad smile lit up her old wrinkled white face, and she nodded and gently patted my hand. That ought to hold her for a while, I thought. During the sermon, Granny looked at me several times and smiled. Yes, she knows now that I'm not dismissing her pleas from my mind. Feeling that my plan was working, I resumed my worship of the elder's wife with a cleansed conscience, wondering what it would be like to kiss her, longing to feel some of the sensuous emotions of which my reading had made me conscious. The service ended, and Granny rushed to the front of the church and began talking excitedly to the elder. I saw the elder looking at me in surprise. Oh, goddamn, she's telling him, I thought with anger. But I had not guessed 1/1000th of it. The elder hurried toward me. Automatically, I rose. He extended his hand, and I shook it. "Your grandmother told me," he said in awed tones. I was speechless with anger.
I didn't want her to tell you that, I said.
She says that you have seen an angel.
The words literally poured out of his mouth. I was so overwhelmed that I gritted my teeth. Finally, I could speak and I grabbed his arm.
No, no, sir. No, sir, I stammered. I didn't say that. She misunderstood me.
The last thing on earth I wanted was a mess like this. The elder blinked his eyes in bewilderment.
What did you tell her?
He asked. I told her that if I ever saw an angel, then I would believe, I said, feeling foolish, ashamed, hating and pitying my believing granny. The elder's face became bleak and stricken. He was stunned with disappointment.
You didn't see an angel, he asked.
No, sir,
I said emphatically, shaking my head vigorously so there could be no possible further misunderstanding.
I see, he breathed in a sigh.
His eyes looked longingly into a corner of the church.
With God, you know, anything is possible,
he hinted hopefully.
But I didn't see anything, I said. I'm sorry about this.
If you pray, then God will come to you, he said.
The church grew suddenly hot. I wanted to bolt out of it and never see it again. But the elder took hold of my arm and would not let me move.
Elder, this is all a mistake. I didn't want anything like this to happen, I said.
Listen, I'm older than you are, Richard, he said. I think that you have in your heart the gift of God.
I must have looked dubious, for he said,
Really, I do.
Elder, please don't say anything to anybody about this, I begged.
Again, his face lit with vague hope.
Perhaps you don't want to tell me because you're bashful, he suggested. Look, this is serious. If you saw an angel, then tell me.
I could not deny it verbally anymore. I could only shake my head at him. In the face of his hope, words seemed useless.
Promise me you'll pray. If you pray, then God will answer, he said.
I turned my head away, ashamed for him, feeling that I had unwittingly committed an obscene act in rousing his hopes so wildly high, feeling sorry for his having such hopes. I wanted to get out of his presence. He finally let me go, whispering,
I want to talk to you sometime.
The church members were staring at me. My fists doubled. Granny's wide and innocent smile was shining on me, and I was filled with dismay. That she could make such a mistake meant that she lived in a daily atmosphere that urged her to expect something like this to happen. She had told the other members, and everybody knew it, including the elder's wife. There they stood, the church members, with joyous astonishment written on their faces, whispering among themselves. Perhaps at that moment I could have mounted the pulpit and led them all. Perhaps that was to be my greatest moment of triumph. Granny rushed to me and hugged me violently, weeping tears of joy. Then I babbled, speaking with emotional reproof, censuring her for having misunderstood me. I must have spoken more loudly and harshly than was called for. The others had now gathered about me and Granny. For Granny drew away from me abruptly and went to a far corner of the church and stared at me with a cold, set face. I was crushed. I went to her and tried to tell her how it had happened.
You shouldn't have spoken to me, she said in a breaking voice that revealed the depths of her disillusionment.
On our way home, she would not utter a single word. I walked anxiously beside her, looking at her tired old white face, the wrinkles that lined her neck,
the deep, waiting black eyes, and the frail body. And I knew more than she thought I knew about the meaning of religion, the hunger of the human heart for that which is not and can never be, the thirst of the human spirit to conquer and transcend the implacable limitations of human life. Later, I convinced her that I hadn't wanted to hurt her, and she immediately seized upon my concern for her feelings as an opportunity to have one more try at bringing me to God. She wept and pleaded with me to pray, really, to pray hard, to pray until tears came. "Granny, don't make me promise," I begged. "But you must, for the sake of your soul," she said. I promised. After all, I felt that I owed her something for inadvertently making her ridiculous before the members of her church. Daily, I went into my room upstairs, locked the door, knelt, and tried to pray, but everything I could think of saying seemed silly. Once it all seemed so absurd that I laughed out loud while on my knees. It was no use. I couldn't pray. I could never pray. But I kept my failure a secret. I was convinced that if I ever succeeded in praying, my words would bound noiselessly against the ceiling and rain back down upon me like feathers. My attempts at praying became a nuisance, spoiling my days, and I regretted the promise I had given Granny. But I stumbled on a way to pass the time in my room, a way that made the hours fly with the speed of the wind. I took the Bible, pencil, paper, and a rhyming dictionary, and tried to write verses for hymns. I justified this by telling myself that, if I wrote a really good hymn, Granny might forgive me. But I failed even in that. The Holy Ghost was simply nowhere near me. One day, while killing my hour of prayer, I remembered a series of volumes of Indian history I had read the year before. Yes, I knew what I would do. I would write a story about the Indians. But what about them? Well, an Indian girl. I wrote of an Indian maiden, beautiful and reserved, who sat alone upon the bank of a still stream, surrounded by eternal twilight and ancient trees, waiting. The girl was keeping some vow, which I could not describe, and, not knowing how to develop the story, I resolved that the girl had to die. She rose slowly and walked toward the dark stream, her face stately and cold. She entered the water and walked on until the water reached her shoulders, her chin, then covered her. Not a murmur or a gasp came from her, even in dying. And at last the darkness of the night descended and softly kissed the surface of the watery grave, and the only sound was the lonely rustle of the ancient trees, I wrote, as I penned the final line. I was excited. I read it over and saw that there was a yawning void in it. There was no plot, no action, nothing save atmosphere and longing and death. But I had never in my life done anything like it. I had made something. No matter how bad it was mine. Now, to whom could I show it? Not my relatives. They would think I'd gone crazy. I decided to read it to a young woman who lived next door. I interrupted her as she was washing dishes, and swearing her to secrecy, I read the composition aloud. When I finished, she smiled at me oddly, her eyes baffled and astonished. "What's that for?" she asked. "Nothing," I said. "But why did you write it?" "I just wanted to." "Where did you get the idea?" I wagged my head, pulled down the corners of my mouth, stuffed my manuscript into my pocket, and looked at her in a cocky manner that said, "Oh, it's nothing at all. I write stuff like this all the time. It's easy, if you know how." But I merely said in a humble, quiet voice, "Well, I don't know. I just thought it up." "What are you going to do with it?" "Nothing."
God only knows what she thought. My environment contained nothing more alien than writing, or the desire to express oneself in writing. But I never forgot the look of astonishment and bewilderment on the young woman's face when I had finished reading and glanced at her. Her inability to grasp what I had done or was trying to do somehow gratified me. Afterwards, whenever I thought of her reaction, I smiled happily for some unaccountable reason. Chapter 5. No longer set apart for being sinful, I felt that I could breathe again, live again, that I had been released from a prison. The cosmic images of dread were now gone, and the external world became a reality, quivering daily before me. Instead of brooding and trying foolishly to pray, I could run and roam, mingle with boys and girls, feel at home with people, share a little of life in common with others, satisfy my hunger to be and live. Granny and Aunt Addie changed toward me, giving me up for lost. They told me that they were dead to the world, and those of their blood who lived in that world were therefore dead to them. From urgent solicitude, they dropped to coldness and hostility. Only my mother, who had in the meantime recovered somewhat, maintained her interest in me, urging me to study hard and make up for squandered time. Freedom brought problems. I needed textbooks and had to wait for months to obtain them. Granny said that she would not buy worldly books for me. My clothes were a despair. So hostile did Granny and Aunt Addie become that they ordered me to wash and iron my own clothes. Eating was still skimpy, but I had now adjusted myself to the starch, lard, and greens diet. I went to school, feeling that my life depended not so much upon learning as upon getting into another world of people. Until I entered Jim Hill Public School, I'd had but 1 year of unbroken study. With the exception of 1 year at the church school, each time I had begun a school term, something happened to disrupt it. Already my personality was lopsided. My knowledge of feeling was far greater than my knowledge of fact. Though I was not aware of it, the next 4 years were to be the only opportunity for formal study in my life. The first school day presented the usual problem, and I was emotionally prepared to meet it. Upon what terms would I be allowed to remain upon the school grounds? With pencil and tablet, I walked nonchalantly into the schoolyard, wearing a cheap, brand-new straw hat. I mingled with the boys, hoping to pass unnoticed, but knowing that, sooner or later, I would be spotted for a newcomer. And trouble came quickly. A black boy bounded past me, thumping my straw hat to the ground and yelling, "Straw Katie!" I picked up my hat, and another boy ran past, slapping my hat even harder. "Straw Katie!" Again I picked up my hat and waited. The cry spread. Boys gathered around, pointing, chanting, "Straw Katie! Straw Katie!" I didn't feel that I'd been really challenged so far. No particular boy had stood his ground and taunted me. I was hoping that the teasing would cease, and tomorrow I would leave my straw hat at home. But the boy who had begun the game came close.
"Mama bought me a straw hat," he sneered.
"Watch what you're saying," I warned him.
"Oh, look, he talks," the boy said.
The crowd howled with laughter, waiting, hoping.
"Where you from?" the boy asked me.
"None of your business," I said.
"Now look, don't you go and get sassy, or I'll cut you down," he said.
"I'll say what I please," I said. The boy picked up a tiny rock and put it on his shoulder and walked close again.
"Knock it off,"
he invited me. I hesitated for a moment, then acted. I brushed the rock from his shoulder and ducked and grabbed him about the legs and dumped him to the ground.
A volcano of screams erupted from the crowd. I jumped upon the fallen boy and started pounding him. Then I was jerked up. Another boy had begun to fight me. My straw hat had been crushed and forgotten.
"Don't you hit my brother!" the new boy yelled. "Two fighting one ain't fair," I yelled.
Both of them now closed in on me. A blow landed on the back of my head. I turned and saw a brick rolling away, and I felt blood oozing down my back. I looked around and saw several brickbats scattered about. I scooped up a handful. The two boys backed away. I took aim as they circled me. I made a motion as if to throw, and one of the boys turned and ran. I let go with a brick and caught him in the middle of his back. He screamed. I chased the other halfway around the schoolyard. The boys howled their delight. They crowded around me, telling me that I had fought with two bullies. Then suddenly the crowd quieted and parted. I saw a woman teacher bearing down upon me. I dabbed at the blood on my neck.
"Was it you who threw that brick?" she asked.
"Two boys were fighting me," I told her.
"Come,"
she said, taking my hand. I entered school escorted by the teacher, under arrest. I was taken to a room and confronted with the two brothers.
"Are these the boys?"
she asked.
"Both of them fought me," I said. "I had to fight back."
"He hit me first," one brother yelled.
"You're lying," I yelled back.
"Don't you use that language in here," the teacher said.
"But they're not telling the truth," I said. "I'm new here, and they tore up my hat."
"He hit me first," the boy said again.
I reached around the teacher, who stood between us, and smacked the boy. He screamed and started at me. The teacher grabbed us.
"The very idea of you," the teacher shouted at me. "You are trying to fight right in school? What's the matter with you?"
"He's not telling the truth," I maintained.
She ordered me to sit down. I did, but kept my eyes on the two brothers. The teacher dragged them out of the room, and I sat until she returned.
"I'm in a good mind not to let you off this time," she said.
"It wasn't my fault," I said.
"I know, but you hit one of those boys right in here," she said.
"I'm sorry."
She asked me my name and sent me to a room. For a reason I couldn't understand, I was assigned to the fifth grade. Would they detect that I didn't belong there? I sat and waited. When I was asked my age, I called it out and was accepted. I studied night and day, and within 2 weeks, I was promoted to the sixth grade. Overjoyed, I ran home and babbled the news. The family hadn't thought it possible. How could a bad, bad boy do that? I told the family emphatically that I was going to study medicine, engage in research, make discoveries. Flushed with success, I hadn't given a second's thought to how I would pay my way through a medical school. But since I had leaped a grade in 2 weeks, anything seemed possible. Simple. Easy. I was now with boys and girls who were studying, fighting, talking. It revitalized my being, whipped my senses to a high, keen pitch of receptivity. I knew that my life was revolving about a world that I had to encounter and fight when I grew up. Suddenly, the future loomed tangibly for me, as tangible as a future can loom for a black boy in Mississippi. Most of my schoolmates worked mornings, evenings, and Saturdays. They earned enough to buy their clothes and books, and they had money in their pockets at school. To see a boy go into a grocery store at noon recess and let his eyes roam over filled shelves and pick out what he wanted, even a dime's worth, was a hairbreadth short of a miracle to me. But when I broached the idea of my working to Granny, she would have none of it. She laid down the injunction that I couldn't work on Saturdays while I slept under her roof. I argued that Saturdays were the only days on which I could earn any worthwhile sum, and Granny looked me straight in the eyes and quoted scripture.
But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou. And that was the final word. Though we live just on the borders of actual starvation, I couldn't bribe Granny with a promise of half or two-thirds of my salary. Her answer was no and never. Her refusal wrought me up to a high pitch of nervousness, and I cursed myself for being made to live a different and crazy life. I told Granny that she wasn't responsible for my soul, and she replied that I was a minor, that my soul's fate rested in her hands, that I had no word to say in the matter. To protect myself against pointed questions about my home and my life, to avoid being invited out when I knew that I couldn't accept, I was reserved with the boys and girls at school, seeking their company, but never letting them guess how much I was being kept out of the world in which they lived, valuing their casual friendships, but hiding it, acutely self-conscious, but covering it with a quick smile and a ready phrase. Each day at noon, I would follow the boys and girls into the corner store and stand against a wall and watch them buy sandwiches. And when they would ask me, "Why don't you eat lunch?" I would answer with a shrug of my shoulders, "Oh, I'm not hungry at noon, ever." And I would swallow my saliva as I saw them split open loaves of bread and line them with juicy sardines. Again and again, I vowed that someday I would end this hunger of mine, this apartness, this eternal difference. And I didn't suspect that I would never get intimately into their lives, that I was doomed to live with them but not of them, that I had my own strange and separate road, a road which in later years would make them wonder how I had come to tread it. I now saw a world leap to life before my eyes because I could explore it, and that meant not going home when school was out, but wandering, watching, asking, talking. Had I gone home to eat my plate of greens, Granny wouldn't have allowed me out again, so the penalty I paid for roaming was to forfeit my food for 12 hours. I would eat mush at 8 in the morning and greens at 7 or later at night. To starve in order to learn about my environment was irrational, but so were my hungers. With my books slung over my shoulder, I would tramp with a gang into the woods, to rivers, to creeks, into the business district, to the doors of pool rooms, into the movies, when we could slip in without paying, to neighborhood ball games, to brick kilns, to lumber yards, to cottonseed mills to watch men work. There were hours when hunger would make me weak, would make me sway while walking, would make my heart give a sudden wild spurt of beating that would shake my body and make me breathless. But the happiness of being free would lift me beyond hunger, would enable me to discipline the sensations of my body to the extent that I could temporarily forget.
This ends Disc 5.